Tonight on Arena, Sam Amadon performs live from his new album Salt River, and Mike Lee, Marianne Jean-Baptiste and Michelle Austin on their new film Hard Truths. is the text. You can find us on socials at RTE Arena. And you can watch us live on rte.ie/arena. Remember that text number, by the way. Renowned for his unique ability to reimagine traditional folk music with a contemporary edge, Sam Amadon's ties to Ireland run deep. From collaborations with the acclaimed Irish choreographer Michael Keegan-Dolan to growing up playing fiddle in his native Vermont. Now Sam is back with a new album called Salt River, a collection spanning traditional numbers and songs by the likes of Lou Reed, Yoko Ono and others, as well as very traditional numbers, but all of them in ways you haven't heard them before. Delighted that Sam is sitting in front of me here in studio this evening. And we're going to start with a song. Lots of people will know this song. They won't know this version of the song. So for the bat-eared among you, listen to the lyrics. Very quickly, you might just identify the song by a punk hero who first released it.
Big sky, holding up the sun. Big sky, holding up the moon. Big sky, holding down the sea. But it can't hold us down anymore. Big sky, holding up the stars. Big sky, holding Venus and Mars. Big sky, catch you in a jar. But it can't hold us down anymore. Big sky, big enormous place. Big wind blow all over the place. Big storm wreaking havoc and waste. But it can't hold us down. Big sin, big original sin. Paradise where I've never been. Big snake, break the skin. But it can't hold us down anymore. Big sky, holding up the sun. Big sky, holding up the moon. Big sky, holding down the sea. But it can't hold us down anymore.
A wonderful acoustic version of Sam Amadon's take on Big Sky, the song, of course, by Lou Reed. Yes, that is the Lou Reed song.
Who'd have thunk it?
Who'd have thunk it, indeed. And had you heard the Lou Reed song, Sam? Thanks a million for being with us and for playing live. Had you heard the Lou Reed song when you went about inventing or reinventing the song, or were you just looking for
I actually
else?
Was leafing through. I have the book of his lyrics, and I was leafing through them, and I found this one, and I hadn't recognized it. I knew the record, Ecstasy. It's a great record, but I didn't ring a bell. And seeing the words out of context, I had heard the song somewhere back there, but the words just seemed like this beautiful, like, prayer or a folk song or lullaby. Mm. And then when I heard his take, which is amazing, I love his recording, but it's dripping with all of that Lou Reed bravado and, you know, all of their elements. So I just thought, man, what if you just took this and made it back into a folk song?
Yeah, because I suppose Lou Reed in some ways is shouting at the big sky and giving out about it for the duration of the song. But also, which tells us something about what songs do, You went at it from the point of view of the lyric. How much did you listen to the Lou Reed version of it after that? Or did you kind of want to keep as far away from it as you could?
I checked it out for sure. And I was like, oh, man, this is deep. But then I just knew that my own voice would have to treat it in a different way. And I really wanted to sing the song. I thought it was so beautiful. And so I actually came up with this acoustic version first that I've just played for you guys and for you. But in the recording, you know, that I made has a lot more synthesizers and stuff. So then we have sort of another version on the record, which is still closer to this one than to
Lou's. Yeah, because it's just you and the guitar in with us this evening. But the record itself, that title, Salt River, in some ways, it's like you, Sam Amadon, folk singer, you know, traditional fiddle player, rubbing up against the kind of punk rock of Lou Reed. You're looking at, with yourself and Philippin Melanson and Sam Gendel, who's the saxophonist, Philip, the percussionist on the album, you're looking at that, the moment where the river meets the sea. So where two things collide and you don't quite know where you are with them. What are the two things that you're looking at colliding?
Well, for me, it was sort of like the world of Sam Gendel and Philippe Melanson, is very electronic. And what I like about them is they have a very soulful, simple approach to what they do. We were just sitting in his living room around his laptop. So they're playing synthesizers and electronic drums and acoustic percussion and you know, saxophone as well. But it was very much that synthesizer sound. And my world is like, I come from Vermont. I grew up in Vermont and when I was a kid in the 80s. It was the 80s, but I didn't notice because I was in a group, you know, my town was like pretending it didn't exist. We still had, you know, they were still living the hippie life. I had no television growing up and I just, you know, listened to folk music. So
Did you know about Lou Reed at that time?
Definitely not. I barely knew what like Prince sounded like. And so in a way I was thinking of this album that I made, Salt River, as like a mixture of my childhood, which is the folk music and the warmth of these old songs, with what was happening around me without realizing it, which was the synthesizers and gated drums of the 80s.
And you mentioned, about this idea that it's almost like sitting around in somebody's kitchen or sitting room. And in fact, the song Friends and Neighbors, which I think, did you do that in Sam in the saxophonist's home?
Yes, and we recorded.
We have this wild track of the three of you, I presume, chatting away.
You can hear us having dinner as well. Yeah. There's some. I should have gotten a percussion credit for my fork and knife. we're chatting away in the background, and then we overlaid the track because that was kind of the spirit of the time together. And it was ironic because we're making. If you listen to the record, it has a very electronic sound, but actually, it was made in an extremely folk way. You know, in a very organic way.
Yeah, and there is an instrument on the album that I meant to ask you about before we came to her. It's kind of not a saxophone.
Oh, yeah. Is it on the Friends and Neighbors track?
Yeah, it's on Friends
and Neighbors. Sarun Bolan.
Is it an old-style shalimar clarinet?
I think it's a sort of
like
Turkish kind of oboe-ish instrument.
Right.
I'd never heard of it or seen it. Sam just pulled it out of nowhere. I don't know where it came from.
It sounds amazing on it, too. Have you been teaching Paul Mescal? About such instruments and such songs. You're busy working with him. And
I did some work on a wonderful forthcoming film called History of Sound. It stars Paul Mescal and Josh O'Connor. And I just gave them some coaching. They're already great musicians, but I gave them some coaching on Appalachian American folk music. And it was a beautiful experience. They're so motivated and focused. And, you know,
they're playing two song collectors or certainly guys interested in that, which would have been something that your own parents had done. Are these real life characters or are they fictional characters?
No, it's based on a short story by Ben Shattuck, which is available. You can find the short story online, actually. It's a wonderful short story, and it's a fictionalization, but it's very much inspired. It was so close to my world because a lot of it takes place around New England, which is where I'm from, but a lot of it deals with Appalachian folk music, which the Appalachian Mountains just about reached to Vermont, but they start more in North Carolina.
I want to ask you briefly about your performance with Nobodaddy, in Nobodaddy with Michael Keegan Dolan and Chuck Dowsa. Did you become the friends and neighbours? Did you go down to Kerry and get yourself out of the real world for a long time?
I certainly did. That was Michael's idea. It seemed like a wild thing to do, but I went for it. I was down there in West Kerry for 8 weeks in July and August. I had an incredible time down there and performing the show.
I know you performed in the Gate on Saturday night. I was mad that I couldn't get there. I just had other commitments.
Worries.
But I'm delighted that this has happened.
Here
this
we
evening.
Are now.
Exactly. And to have you in the studio opposite me is a real treat. I asked you to change one of the songs that you're going to sing, and you've kind of shortened it down, and you're doing an acoustic version of it. Tell me about a song I've never heard before, Golden Willow Tree.
This is an old ballad. This is my, you know, the home territory of the reworked folk song thing. This is an old, which will be known to, you know, people of Ireland with Irish music. It's been done many times. But this is an Appalachian ballad. It's a child ballad. So it came from these islands originally and made its way to America. I don't know where specifically, but I learned it from Almeda Riddle, who is a profound ballad singer from the Ozarks. And it's from the Alan Lomax collection. So it would have been recorded in the 50s. And I just was really touched and moved by the story.
Yeah, the story is incredible here, and you have to sing all the verses, but you've kind of given us a tightened up version of it. Let us hear Golden Willow Tree, performed live by Sam Amidon. Listen to the story.
Here's the story. There was a little ship, and she sailed on the sea. And the name of this ship was the Golden Willow Tree, sailing on the lonesome low, sailing on the lonesome sea. Now she hadn't been sailing 2 weeks or three, when she spied that ship, the Turkish Robbery, sailing on the lonesome low, sailing on the lowland sea. There was a cabin boy upon the Golden Tree. Said, Captain, oh Captain, what will you give to me if I sink them in the lonesome low, sink that Turkish Robbery? Oh, half of my ship shall be made unto thee, and my youngest daughter will be wed unto thee. If you sink them in the lonesome low, sink them in the lowland sea. So he took his little tool and he jumped overboard. He said, I'll be as good as my word. He was swimming in the lonesome low, swimming in the lowland sea. He took his little tool, just made for that use, and he bore 12 holes for to let in the dew. They were sinking in the lonesome low, sinking in the lowland sea. Sailors off with their coats, and some with their caps. They were trying to fill up the salt water gaps. They were sinking in the lonesome low, drowning in the lowland sea. He turned around and away swam he, until he returned to the Golden Willow Tree, sailing on the lonesome low, sailing on the lowland sea. Oh, Captain, are you as good as your word? Then take this poor sailor man on board. For I'm drowning in the lonesome low, I'm drowning in the lowland sea. I will not give you wealth, nor give you fame, my youngest
his daughter has a time-honored name. I'll just leave you in the lonesome low, leave you drowning in the lowland sea. He turned on his back, and away floated he. Said, fare you well to the golden willow tree. I'm drowning in the lonesome low, drowning in the lowland sea.
You make business deals with, be very careful who you make business deals. Wonderful version there of Golden Willow Tree, one of the songs on Salt River, the new album from Sam Amidon. It's out now. I recommend it highly. Sam, thank you so much for coming into
us this
evening.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
After two historical films, Mr. Turner and Peter Lou, and a break for 6 years, believe it or not, Mike Lee is back in the present day with a new film. Hard Truths stars Secrets and Lies collaborator Marianne Jean-Baptiste as Pansy, deeply unhappy woman, angry with the world, and that anger is constantly boiling over. It has poisoned her relationship with her husband, her son, and it's certainly taking a toll on her sister Chantelle, played by Michelle Austin. As always with Mike Lee's works, the characters, story and script emerge through an intense process of workshopping involving all the actors, and despite the disappointment of not being selected for Cannes or Venice Film Festivals this year, Hard Truths has been receiving critical acclaim, especially for Marianne Jean-Baptiste, who is nominated for the BAFTA for Best Actress. Kay Sheehy spoke to the stars of the film, Marianne Jean-Baptiste, who, as I say, plays Pansy, and Michelle Austin, who plays her kind hearted sister Chantelle. She also spoke with Mike Lee about how he makes films in general, and this film in particular, and about how Pansy is a surprisingly relatable character. We'll hear Kay's conversation with Mike Lee shortly, but first of all, a clip. Here's Pansy talking, or is it ranting, about the events of her day as she eats dinner with her husband and son.
And then round the corner with that dog, got it dressed up in a red coat and green booties. Why's the dog got on a coat? It's got fur in it. Must be sweating under there, stinking. That's cruelty to animals, that is. Putting it under all that plastic. I've got a mind to report him to the NSPCG or whatever they call them. And her over there with that fat baby. Cold, 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 and she's walking up and down the street with nothing but a big pink bow on its bald head so everybody can tell it's a girl, like I care. Parading it around in the little outfit, not dressed for the weather, nah, with pockets. What's a baby got pockets for? What's it gonna keep in its pocket? A knife? It's ridiculous.
Describing your creative process, Marianne Jean-Baptiste has said that you grow a film. So could you tell us what were the seeds in your head for this film?
Well, it's a hard question to answer because I have notions on the go all the time. But really, what I do is to decide to work with an actor or with some actors, and then we talk into existence a character or characters. And that's what I did with Marianne. So the first premise was just to work with her, knowing how versatile she is, and that, in fact, the sky's the limit, there are infinite possibilities. And gradually, we drawing from sources of real people she knows and so on, we somehow, in a way that's hard to describe and in a way is a sort of trade secret, we spun the character into existence alongside the other characters, particularly her sister. And so it's hard to sort of talk about the seeds in my head quite as tangibly as your question assumes.
Could you describe Pansy for us, and how did the character emerge without giving away any of your trade secrets?
Well, I mean, you know, she's a difficult woman. She has, plainly, she has problems and issues with other people. She is depressed, She is isolated. She is aggressive. But she's in pain, and I hope, though I don't want to discuss it because people will see the film, that gradually, as you watch the film, you get to understand something about the causes of her pain. I mean, the film is never actually explicit or expositional, because it doesn't need to be, because, you know, you, the audience, will begin to understand because of the various things that happen within the film. You know, the interesting thing about her condition is that any number of people who've seen the film say, oh, well, I know her. That's my mother, that's my sister, that's my dad, that's my guy that used to live next door, etc. I mean, it's a common syndrome in one form or another. And it's the pain of living for a lot of people, you know.
This film has been very difficult to get off the ground. I'm sure that's nothing new to you in terms of the kinds of projects you do when you come to production houses. There, you know, you don't have a script, you don't really have a scenario, but you're hoping that they will invest in you and your previous work and know that you will deliver. But was this particularly difficult in that regard?
Yes, I mean, it's true that, you know, I don't have a script. I mean, you said I virtually know. There is, in fact, no scenario at all, because I say we don't know what we're going to do. I mean, we do make these films by embarking on a journey of discovery to find out what the film is. And certainly we all say we can't discuss casting or anything. And please don't interfere with it while we're making it, you know. So that does result in a high proportion of negative responses. Thus, yes, it's more difficult to raise money for a film, albeit that a film like this was really peanuts by way of its budget, you know, relative to some other projects I've done, and relative to most other movies. It's got harder, actually, because obviously I've made a lot of films over the years. It has got harder, there's no question. The gap between Peterloo and this film is partly for that reason, and also partly we were going to make a film in 2020, but COVID put paid to that. So yeah, it's taken a while.
The last time we spoke, it was about Peterloo, which was obviously a historical film. There is no difference, is there, in your approach, even though that was a historic event?
No, I mean, in terms of creating characters and working on character work and all of that, of course, that's the same. I mean, the difference is obvious that, you know, there's a great deal more research needed to create the world of the beginning of the 19th century or the later 19th century, as we did in Topsy Turvy and Mr. Turner. But the research is the thing. But there's always research. I mean, Michelle Austin went to great lengths to know how to be a hairdresser for real, so that she could do it and have a conversation with them, do all that quite esoteric stuff that black ladies have done to their hair, you know. There's always research. And obviously, with the likes of Peterloo, there was a massive amount of research because we had to breathe life into that world that, although it is the 19th century is only the day before yesterday, it still is a little bit remote as well.
The process you use, again, it is improvisation, but you then write a script and that script is not improvised around. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I don't, just technically speaking, I don't go away and write a script on paper or on my word processor. We've scripted it through rehearsal. So we will do improvisations and then stop and break them down and build them up, and through rehearsal, arrive at something that's very precise. So what you see on screen is always very precisely scripted, but there isn't a script involved in the sense of putting things down on the page. It comes out of the actual organic process of rehearsal.
I know in Vera Drake, there was some scenarios that you were working on, improvisational scenarios and scripts, obviously, that some actors weren't privy to what was happening in the other scenarios, so that the final scene could be believably confrontational, if I'm putting it correctly.
What you've just described is always, always the case. I mean, obviously, there was a difference in the historical films because people knew what they were taking part in. But this film, Hard Truths, is identical to most of the other films, including Vera Drake, where the actors did not know. The deal with the actors in the first place is when I ask them to take part, I always say to each actor, you will never know anything about the whole thing except what your character knows, so that the whole thing can be explored completely truthfully. And people aren't pretending not to know what they shouldn't know or so. So relationships grow in a completely, I mean, you know, if you and I knew each other, which we don't, that probably there will be aspects of this conversation that will be different. But the fact that we each have a perception of it, each of the other, but we actually don't know each other, is part of the psychology or the chemistry or the subtext or whatever you choose to call it, of this conversation we're having.
Now, Marianne Jean-Baptiste, you had worked with her before you in Secrets and Lies and previously. What is it about her as an actress that you so like working with?
Well, she's a consummate character actress. And character actors is what I work with, people who don't play themselves, who are brilliant at doing real people, other people out there in the street. She is fantastic. She's got an enormous sense of humour. She's a joy to work with. And she knows how to really push herself, as you see in her performance as Pansy, and plumb the depths of a character, but she is absolutely 1,000 miles away from the character she plays in this film. You know, she's an extremely well-adjusted and proper person, you know.
And how different was the experience of working with her back in the 1990s in Secrets and Lies?
Well, back then, she was a young actress and I was a middle-aged person. Now, she's a respectable middle-aged lady and I'm an octogenarian. So we bring to it more life experience. She's a mother and I'm a grandfather. You know, we dig deeper and hopefully what we do has, I suppose, greater resonance. But really, in actual terms, and I think the terms of the question you're asking me, really, it's much the same, because we were really very creative then, I think, if I could say. And I think I'd say we were creative this time.
Mike Lee, thank you very much. A delight to talk to you.
You too. Thank you.
22-year-old man and he's still eating peanut butter and jam sandwiches. I talk to him until I'm tired. I say, Moses, what are you doing with your life? Where do you see yourself in 25 years' time? I'm sick of it.
Do you want me to talk to him?
And say what?
I don't know. Just see if I can help him.
What, you're trying to insinuate yourself into my family?
Insinuate how?
You wouldn't like it if I talked to your girls like that.
And said what?
Why are you going out exposing your belly to the world? What are you doing dressed up in a squeeze-up, tie-top, yoga pants and you're not even in the gym? You wouldn't like it. You wouldn't like it at all. Some sisters are close, you know. Some sisters confide in each other.
You can confide in me.
Nah, if I don't call you, you don't call me.
I call you.
Nah, I have to call you and say, oh, Chantel, my hair needs doing. Oh, Chantel, my back is hurting. Can you pick me up a couple of things from Kilburn?
I call you.
Hey, put down them scissors. You're getting aggressive.
Marianne Jean-Baptiste and Michelle Austin, you're both very welcome to Arena.
Thank you.
Now, in Hard Truths, you're playing sisters Pansy and Chantel, who are living in London but have very different lives. Marianne, your character Pansy is a very funny character, but it comes out of a deep anger she has, a deep anger with her family, with her lovely sister, and then with the world in general. How did you find that anger within yourself or within your character?
Well, I think most anger stems from pain. And that was what, you know, was the anchor to find that. I mean, I think we all have anger within us. Do you know what I mean? It depends on how we use it, whether it's something that motivates us or something that sort of like reduces us in a sense, you know. And with Pansy, because she's not quite, she doesn't quite know where the pain is coming from. She just knows that she's feeling it, which in and of itself makes her angry. So there was a lot of stuff to sort of motivate her behavior, if you like.
And then you work on improvisational scenes. I know that covers a multitude of ways of interacting. But you have your character, and out of the various scenes, either with your husband or with Chantal, your sister, you're developing that sense of anger and pain.
Mm-hmm. And disappointment. And I think a lot of it before that, I mean, before we even interact with anybody else, we start growing the character, you know, in finite detail. So every heartbreak, every disappointment, you know, before she even meets her husband, every failure, we've worked all that stuff out. And as we know, people take those things into the relationships they have, you know, even if it's not the person that hurt them, you know, they often play it out on whoever's available in Pansy's case.
And Michelle, your character then is, it seems so light in comparison to Pansy. She has a wonderful relationship with her two girls. She really loves Pansy, though she struggles to understand her, where the anger and maybe where the pain comes from. She's an inkling where the pain comes from.
I think that it's that situation where I think Chantal has found life to be easy or easier, and she's also been able to deal with her disappointments and kind of thrive from them, if you like. And I think what we discovered and what we explored was, you know, they had very different experiences of their childhood and of their mum, and that was sort of intrinsic to their relationship. And also, I think there is something in the fact that Chantal is the younger sister, so probably did have less responsibility in the household. Yeah, life is easy. I mean, I have to be honest with you. I mean, I wish I could kind of wander through life like Chantal. And she is based on some women that I have met who seem to have a warmth where they bring people in, you know, and they make life sort of easier, and they make situations easier and gentle for people. You know, there's that energy, which is so, so interesting.
And of course, Chantal's work is as a hairdresser. And I think you went and researched being a hairdresser. And it is so interpersonal, isn't it? So you can see her kindness when she's working with her clients.
Yeah, and I think, and it's a sort of cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true, you know, our hairdressers, for most women, our hairdressers are so important to us. We follow our hairdressers around the country. I mean, I was talking to a journalist the other day whose hairdresser now lives in another country, flies over and cuts 10 women's hair and then flies back. I mean, like, it's nuts when you think about it, but it is so important to us. There is something so special about that relationship. Mm-hmm. And for a lot of people, it's sometimes the only touch that they get, and it's so intimate, that thing about somebody putting their hands on your head and massaging your scalp. And I love that about Chantal. But yes, I did go, to answer your question, yes, I did go and go to hairdressers, sit in hairdressers, wash people's hair, sweet cut hair, met some incredible women who've literally been working hard, grafting since they were 17, and, you know, and now own the business. And yeah, I loved doing it. Thought that I could probably do it myself by the end because I'm that arrogant. But obviously I have forgotten everything.
And a lot of humour comes from the fact then that Pansy, even when she's getting her hair done by her sister, can't even enjoy that. Whereas we've seen Chantal's other clients luxuriating in her company.
Can she not?
Yeah, but I do think that as much as Pansy is able to enjoy it, she enjoys it. She enjoys that connection. She'll complain about it the whole time, but she actually needs her to be there, you know, because I mean, when you even sit and analyse the scene, there's sort of discussion of, as to whether she actually needs her hair done in the first place. But she's found an excuse to get her sister around there for that little bit of contact.
Yeah.
And for someone to beat up a bit.
Show me where it's tight.
At the back, look, it's all red.
The scalp's not red, it's flaky where you're scratching it.
Because it's too tight.
You drinking water?
Of course I'm drinking water. What's that got to do with it?
Keep your skin hydrated.
I'm hydrated enough. Ugh, anybody would think you were trying to pull me brains out. That's attached to my head, you know.
I know, because I put it there myself.
Boy, you really know how to administer punishment. You should have been a prison warden. Mm. I hope you don't rough up your customers like that.
Nah, because they pay me.
Nah, the money thing again. You should treat your family like how you treat strangers.
Going back into the Mike Leigh world after, like, Secrets and Lies was back in the 1990s, is it daunting, or do you go, oh, this is going to be a wonderful experience, or do you feel, oh, my God, I'm going to be so exposed and excavated?
Well, you feel terrified, but you feel exhilarated. You're excited because you know what that journey is. You know it's going to be a journey of discovery. You know that it's going to be organic. You know that you're going to really sort of like roll your sleeves up and use every ounce of your talent.
Does the experience of working with Mike Leigh translate into other jobs you do? Do you bring something new to other jobs you do, or do you go, all right, it's back to script work and back maybe more to doing stuff on your own that you bring to the set?
Yeah, no, I think ever since working with him our first time, that we've sort of tried to incorporate some of the stuff that we learned from him, you know, especially in when working on a character. You know, I always try and base it on somebody that I know in real life and work out from the script, obviously, the journey of the character, but really just try and make a rich history for them so that it's grounded. So that,
Absolutely the same since working with him. I always try and base my characters on somebody that I've seen or met and, you know, create the history. I mean, obviously a lot of some of this, you know, this stuff you sort of, you do at drama school and things, but yeah, it has been a grounding for just everything really.
There's loads of awards buzz around your performances in this. Marion, if you win the BAFTA for Best Actress, you would be the first black woman to do so. That's kind of extraordinary, isn't it?
Wow.
Really? Wow.
That's shocking, really.
Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you say?
Yeah.
You know.
Are you excited about the award season coming up and what it might?
Yeah, it's very exciting. It really is. The whole thing has been such a wonderful experience. You know, not only to get to work with Mike Leigh again, but to make a work that we really enjoyed making and for it to resonate with people the way that it has. I mean, that in itself is an award, you know, so it's just the gift that keeps on giving at the moment. And we're like, yeah, just keep on giving, please.
Marianne and Michelle, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Marianne Jean-Baptiste and Michelle Austin there talking to Keshi about their roles in Hard Truths. Before that, we heard from the writer and director of the film, Mike Leigh. Hard Truths opens in cinemas this Friday. We'll be reviewing it on Thursday night's Arena. Over a week ago, we spoke to Ian Hardwick about channeling the poet Louis MacNeice at the Gaith Theatre's Dead Poets Live event on the last day of this month, which is next Friday, this coming Friday, that is. One of my next guests, actor Peter MacDonald, will join Anthony Boyle and Alwyn Ferreira in Three Ages of Yeats when Peter will draw on some of the Yeats's most famous works from September 1913 to Easter 1916 and Wild Swans at Coole the night before. On Thursday, January the 30th, actor Justine Mitchell, star of Smother and Bad Sisters, will be Emily Dickinson. I'm delighted that Justine is with me here in studio and Peter joins us on the line. Peter, just coming to you first of all, immediately I think of Tom Owen, Paths of Freedom. I think of The Machine and the Stag, Git Hines and I Went Down, Stanislav, the brother of Joyce in Nora.
Yeah,
there's a few other kind of iconic roles. Johnny Giles in The Damned United. You recently starred in this. It does go on. And you're part of the DC Universe now at the moment as Detective William Kenzie. So is there a wonderful, let's get back to basics and have a look at the poetry of W.B. Yeats and kind of go back to a kind of a roots and branch type of approach to what you do?
I do a lot of theatre. Well, I used to do a lot of theatre in London. I've always tried to keep doing that, but this is a different venture, and I've actually done a show with them before, which centred around the work of Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Yes, and has that helped you, or was that experience so positive that when you were asked about the Yeats show, you said, "Yeah, I'm in."
Absolutely, and I'd seen some of their shows before, and it's a great idea, and the guys who run and devise the shows along with Claire, it's run through the T.S. Eliot estate. It just makes the poems come alive in a very different way. And just the idea to get, you know, good seasoned theatrical performers to inhabit these poets, get up on stage and, you know, the whole evening is, you know, a narrative of their lives, their thoughts, their philosophies, peppered with their work throughout. And there's something about poetry live performed by actors that is kind of electrifying. I was actually quite taken aback at how powerful it could be. And there's something about poetry and poets as artists. There's nowhere to hide.
No.
In poetry,
not.
You know, and a poem either works or it doesn't.
But I guess in the case of these two performances, you've chosen the poems that they're contextualized within certain periods. You're specifically looking at the Maud Gonne period in some ways, Maud Gonne, and then his own marriage later on. When the marriage proposal to Maud Gonne disappeared, and then when he got married himself later on, you're in that spot in his life.
Yeah, I'm in the middle years.
Yeah.
So the play is really a conversation between the three ages of Yeats.
Yeah.
And I mean, she was such a pervasive influence, inspiration, and struggle in his life.
Yeah.
That passion never really left him.
Yeah. You're in the lucky position, because I want to turn to Justine now, who's with me here in the studio. Peter's in the lucky position in that lots of stuff out there about Yeats, and Yeats was fond of making the odd speech himself and telling you all about him, telling us all about himself. You're in the envious, perhaps unenvious, I don't know, role of trying to find Emily Dickinson, who was incredibly private and, of course, almost ignored during her lifetime.
Yeah, she makes literary detectives drool. You know, she is a mystery. She's an ellipsis, and there are so many books that cover the lacunae in her life. You know, yeah.
Let's listen to one of her poems, because you talk about the lacunae or the gaps in her life. The poems are the same.
Yeah,
they're full of these kind of little gaps and spaces. There's nothing on the page that isn't needed in many ways. I Felt a Funeral in My Brain, I think, is probably the poem, if you said to most people Emily Dickinson, it's probably the first one would come out of their mouth, I would guess. You've chosen that for us. Why that one? Because of its popularity, is it, Justine?
Yeah, and it's so spankingly fresh, you know. I don't know exactly when this was written. She wrote 663 poems just between the ages of 29 and 32. In 1862 alone, she wrote 366 poems. I think this was within that time. But I chose it because it just feels like 2024 as much as 1862.
Back in the day. Let's have a listen.
I felt a funeral in my brain, and mourners to and fro kept treading, till it seemed that sense was breaking through. And when they all were seated, a service like a drum kept beating, till I thought my mind was going numb. And then I heard them lift a box and creak across my soul with those same boots of lead again. Then space began to toll, as all the heavens were a bell, and being but an ear, and eye, and silence some strange race, wrecked, solitary, here. And then a plank in reason broke, and I dropped down, and down, and hit a world at every plunge, and finished knowing. Then...
Justine Mitchell reading I Felt a Funeral in My Brain, one of the poems that she will perform as part of Dead Poets Live, an event which is at the Gate Theatre this Thursday and Friday. Justine will be there on Thursday, and Peter MacDonald, who's also online with us here, will be there on Friday. To what extent do you find yourself, Justine, looking for a character called Emily Dickinson, or is it something different that you're doing with poetry here? Like, I can't imagine that this is the same as playing, I can't say too much about your character in Smother for those who haven't watched it, about playing somebody like that, or indeed some of the other television pieces that you have been involved in down the year, Black Doves, Eileen Ryan and Bad Sisters, you're in The Dry as well. What is this process? How does it differ from those characters and finding those characters?
I think I'm going to only stab at a guess here, but I don't think I'll know the answer to this until it's called Dead Poets Live. She'll be resurrected on for one night only.
Thursday night. And
it'll be not just me making her come alive. It'll be the audience. I know I've talked to Peter a lot. He's a good friend. And I asked him, what's it like doing this? And he said, it is all about the audience. And giving it away to them, giving the poetry away to them.
So you're lifting the poems up off the page and you're sending them out down into the house, and then the audience do with them what they will.
100%.
Yeats never won to hide his light under a bushel, Peter. Men improve with the years, he tells us in one of the poems you're going to read for us.
Yeah, I know.
He's some boy, isn't he?
I know. Yeats, I mean, there's so much he wrote in his lifetime. Mm. And I think the kind of extraordinary thing about Yeats was that a lot of people would say that he wrote actually his best poetry between the age of 50 and 70. So his passion for his craft and how connected he was to it actually developed over time.
And so you said 15 to 70, so that's a long career.
No, I'm afraid not, no, 50.
Oh, 50, I beg your pardon. Yes,
yeah, 50 to 70.
Yeah, so later on.
Which is very unusual in any profession, but particularly for an artist who had been published at a young age, you know, in his 20s. So he'd been around for a long time and had published a lot of poetry and a lot of plays. But for him to continually find inspiration, and, you know, he searched around everywhere for the spur and the kick to make, and sometimes in the wrong directions. And, you know, there are Victorian parts of Yeats that are less palatable to a modern audience. But I think the great thing about him is that, I mean, obviously he was just a great lyrical poet. But he put all his passion, his naivety, his visions, he put everything into his poetry. Yeah. So it's all in there. Yeah, There's nothing hidden.
Let's have a listen to him saying how great we are when we get older. Men improve with the years.
Okay, here we go. I am worn out with dreams, a weather-worn marble triton among the streams. And all day long I look upon this lady's beauty as though I had found in a book a pictured beauty, pleased to have filled the eyes or the discerning ears, delighted to be but wise, for men improve with the years. And yet, is this my dream or the truth? Oh, would that we had met when I had my burning youth. But I grow old among dreams, a weather-worn marble Triton among the streams.
Peter MacDonald reading William Butler Yeats' Men Improve With the Years. And it isn't quite the boast that that title suggests. It is interesting how it turns into something totally different. Justine, I've been saying to both of you about the television careers. Obviously, The Gaiety, you're no stranger to The Gaiety either. Bash, Blithe Spirit and Pride and Prejudice and lots of theatre awards within all of those. Is there a sense of home from home?
At The Gaiety, oh my goodness, I was born in the Rotunda. And the first time...
Actually, you were meant to... Well, you needed to go upstairs to start performing.
Exactly. I remember the first time I was on that stage. You were
delivered on the stage, weren't you, Justine?
Oh, darling.
It's part of a very important and very dramatic entrance, I'm guessing.
Yes, exactly. No, it meant a lot. It meant a lot when every time I've done a play there, it meant a lot.
I do want to finish up with an Emily Dickinson poem. But coming back to you on it, Peter, it's a while from you've been in The Gaiety, certainly, but theatre and screen and your writing career, let's not forget that side of things, they've continued to run all alongside. I suppose that's how men last with the years as well as improve with the years, and women too.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, one of the best ways to keep a career going is to write parts for yourself.
There you go. lovely to have you with us, and best of luck on Friday night. As I say,
you will thank be there. Thank you very much.
You'll be there with Anthony Boyle and Alwyn Ferreira. On this Thursday night, it will be Justine Mitchell in the persona, or exploring the persona through the poems of Emily Dickinson. Let's finish with "I'm Nobody, Who Are You?"
I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Well, then there is a pair of us. Oh, don't tell. They'd advertise, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public, like a frog, to tell one's name the livelong June to an admiring bog.
I'm nobody. Who are you? Which also shows, just as a few seconds, there's a lot of humour in there as well. It's easy to think of her as, you know, very intense, but the humour is all over the
this
stuff as well, Justine.
This woman was so witty and full of incredible put-downs.
All right, that's Justine Mitchell, Emily Dickinson this Thursday evening, and Peter MacDonald along with Anthony Boyle and Alwyn Ferreira with William Butler Yeats on this Friday evening, Dead Poets Live, gaitytheatre.ie. We'll give you all of the details there. And that is our lot for this Monday evening. Leah Murphy researched. Dolly Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Reg Luby. You're going to be Doyle there for a minute for some reason. Reg, don't know why. Reg Luby was our producer's name. I will be back with you tomorrow, 7 o'clock, here on RTÉ Radio 1. And I believe John Creedon is back in the seat. If it's not him, it's Ray Cuddihy after the 8 o'clock news.